Please pray after me. O Heavenly Father.
O Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Blessed Master.
Blessed Master.
Dearest Mother.
Dearest Mother.
Beloved David.
Beloved David.
Saints and sages of all religions.
Saints and sages of all religions.
I bow to all of you.
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles.
Free my life from all obstacles.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only King.
Be thou the only King.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
To note with mother's many tapes and talks how many times that exact prayer is said, 1960s all the way through. Her closing prayer varied with an alternate ending sometimes, but a reading from the Bible this morning is St. Luke chapter 19, verse 1 through 11. And Jesus entered and passed through Jericho. And behold, there was a man named Zacchaeus, which was the chief among the publicans. And he was rich. And he sought to see Jesus, who he was. And he sought to see Jesus, who he was, and could not for the press, because he was of little stature. And he ran before and climbed up into a sycamore tree to see him, for he was to pass that way. And when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and saw him and said unto him, Zacchaeus, make haste and come down, for today I must abide at thy house. And he made haste and came down and received him joyfully. And when they saw it, they all murmured, saying that he has gone to be a guest with a man that is a sinner. And Zacchaeus stood and said unto the Lord, behold, Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor. And if I have taken anything from any man by false accusation, I restore him fourfold. And Jesus said unto him, this day is salvation come to this house, for so much as he also is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man is come to seek and to save that which was lost. And as they heard these things, he added and spake a parable, because he was nigh to Jerusalem, and because they thought that the kingdom of God should immediately appear. Many of you have the copy of this book, David's year of writings during his year of silence. It turned out to be an amazing time for us all, especially for him, what he went through. There's some surprising things in here. We had a wonderful Friday, the Mahasmadhi day itself, at his gravesite, and it was really nice. We really had a nice group there, and the feeling was fantastic. Perfect weather. So I'm going to read randomly just a short bit. July 10th, 2001. 1 week ago today, July 3rd, 6 p.m. Interesting. So he's saying from July 10th, he's saying 1 week ago. I was suddenly in the midst of some tremendous grief. It enveloped me for some time. It came from no discernible source, and I believed it was not mine, but came from some outside source. Today in the early afternoon, my solar plexus became very painful. Again, no discernible source within me, but the pain has been excruciating. It lasted in its full intensity until past 6:30. I was doubled up in pain most of all that time. I lay down for some time. The idea came that this pain belonged to the world. When this thought came, I perceived the world contained in my stomach cavity. As soon as this occurred, I had relief from the excruciating pain for the first time in 6 hours. I then wondered if there was some connection between the occurrences on the 3rd and today. Nothing is clear about that, only the question is there. I write only what I experience and what I have realized and do not embellish or say more than I have realized. Many would say these are imaginings, and if I did not have these experiences, I might be one of them. Now, I only say what is true. That is enough. Today in America, a version of jhana is what is popular. American Buddhism is focused on self-awareness without any connotations of God or religious commitment, and with some implicit promise of tantric powers. Compassion is an empathic feeling of sympathy and for suffering. Much of this movement is high-minded. However, the power of transformation often falls short of human capacity. It is a relatively safe path, promised without the deeper notions of surrender. The bhakti spirit is noticeably less a part of the current popular wave. The popularity of Krishnadas devotional music is the first hint at a popular swing towards bhakti. The power of bhakti has yet to see an ascendancy. I believe when it does, its power will eclipse the young movement of today. Surely the heart must respond in a way that the mind alone cannot. It is a lovely thought to think of thousands in kirtan feeling the uplifting vibrations, lifting heart, mind, and soul like a rising tide, lifting all boats and making it all to float in a sea of bliss. O Ram, will we live to see that day? How lovely to contemplate when God's names are sung with devotion and change this world. So I love the book is called Silence, but the subtitle is just as important in all of these books, it seems. It's entering the cosmic sea of consciousness. And that's the way David wrote it. Both Jill and I thought when we read it that maybe it was wrong. Or at least in my own mind, when I said it in my own mind, I thought it was the sea of cosmic consciousness. And then I read it again, and then I found a place in the book where Ruth had pulled it from, and it is entering the cosmic sea of consciousness. So in thinking that, we don't know what David was thinking, but it is a powerful way to think of it. It's not like he's differentiating, saying, well, I'm now entering the sea of cosmic consciousness. I'm leaving the lower world's consciousness. I'm not sure it's making it through the microphone, but we can hardly speak because there's a plane going by. But entering the cosmic sea of consciousness means that all consciousness is cosmic. But the silence allows him to enter it, to enter the cosmic sea of consciousness. I remember when Ruth first sent this copy out, or was talking about the name of the book, I saw that subtitle and I just loved that, because it just had in my own mind this notion that God, David was thinking that he was sinking into this sea of cosmic consciousness, or the cosmic sea of consciousness, but he was entering into it in a forthright way by going into silence and also removing himself from his day-to-day life. Both those things are really important, as it turns out, because it emphasized, it forced him to see that silence in a different way and to go within even more. It gave him that opportunity. Another interesting thing in the back, Ruth has put about the author, and she quotes David saying this: "An inner pain brought me to the path most unwillingly, and this inner pain kept me on the path. I put my shoulder to the wheel." That's a strange thing, in a way. I know when I first knew David that he talked that way more than he did in later years. That spurred him to get involved was some relief of pain that he'd had from his childhood. I think we all have this at different degrees and different times. But it's definitely part of his his experience. Josh sent a really cute thing here. And I want to let you guys to get kicked out. So I've been going through David's emails to me, and I came across this one. And I thought, what is that? And I first clicked on it, I didn't understand what it was. So Josh just sent a happy birthday video. I hope you can all see it correctly here.
Get up!
I know that he loved it. He must have loved it. He sent it around to us, several of us. So, Jerry, we read your requested statement at David's gravesite. And be nice to have coffee with you again, David. And so many other people we've done it with over the years.
David, will you talk about when you first met David and when you first came to
I talked about that a little bit the last time, but sure. Yeah, it was a kind of a hazy memory of exactly, you know, anything specific about a time anyway. So I guess when I was at Mother's apartment for the Christmas thing, it was I already knew David fairly well because I had a distinct idea of him. And I think what was noticeable from pretty much the beginning was his commitment to Mother and to the path. And his desire to fulfill the vows he'd taken as a Kriyaban very strictly and to not vary. Most people were more blasé about it or, you know, just deciding on their own personal life whether they should have a drink, maybe a particular place, maybe just one, maybe they smoke a cigarette or. I'm not saying this is common. I'm just saying that there's an attitude that, well, can't mean forever. But David, I mean, I can't mean for everything and to look at it strictly. I know one thing that really influenced him was he asked Mother, and you guys have all heard him talk about that, could he drink for sociability when his father, you know, wanted to toast something at a family meeting. She said, you can have sociability or you can have God, but not both. And so being around him was, I think that was probably, he was more dogmatic. So I guess from our point of view, the people who knew him at the time, he was seen as a little more dogmatic. He was well-liked, but that's about the only thing I can say that kind of strikes me as unique to him compared to others. We all love to talk about Mother. We all love to talk about the philosophies of the East and Mother's particular view of it. When Ramchandra Gandhi came to town, he was Gandhi's grandson. We got a chance to take classes from him. And I remember, and David and I were going to school through my 4 years or so, three to eight years I was at the University of Washington and living in student housing. David was living with me for a short time there, and also he was going to school then and afterwards. So I saw him around school. But yeah, we both enjoyed the classes that Ramchandra Gandhi gave. And I'm not sure he didn't take credit for the one philosophy class, which I did. And I think he did take credit for the one that Gandhi talked about his grandfather. So there was, like I said, there was two classes. One was basically a 500 level philosophy class, and the other one was, an undergraduate introduction to Gandhi and Gandhiism and his family and memories. And then we had Professor Conlon, who was another constant discussion of these same topics that we all are interested in here too. And Professor Conlon really gave us, he taught Eastern religions and history of India and some other things. So I must have taken, I think I counted three or four classes over the years from him. And David took two or three. Kate took quite a few. And he's a delightful person. Professor Conlon actually wrote a book about the Saraswat Brahmins that Papa was a part of. And I forget what it's called now, but I talked to him years later, and he said, I asked him if he was going to update it because he knew a lot more about the history. He traveled through all that part of India, and he traced the lineage of that Saraswat group coming from way up north in Kashmir, that kind of area. And so the book, I've seen a copy of it, but I think it's at the University of Washington where I saw it. It's a fairly small book, but he never updated it, unfortunately. But he met Mataji and Swamiji. So we had that in common. And when I brought Swami Vishwananda to the university, showing him around, I just, on happenstance, this was the year 2000 when David was in silence, we were showing him around the city. And I said, it would be interesting to see if Professor Conlon is here today. And I had been to the university probably 10 times over those years between when I was there and that 2000. And I think maybe only once that I remember I saw him in his office. So this time, sure enough, God arranged it. He was in his office. And it was a love feast. They both had so many similar memories. And they spoke Konkani. So I was surprised. I knew that Professor Conlon spoke it, but I didn't know that he was casual with it and knew it that well. So. And then we had a class with Professor Williams, who was the religious classes that Professor Conlon taught were in the religious, comparative religion. In those days, I'm not sure today, but in those days, you're not allowed to teach a religion class, but you can teach a comparative religion. And so that was more palatable to people, and at least in public universities. So Professor Williams taught more Christian stuff as his specialty. He knew, what's her name, Paulia?
Pagel.
Pagel, thank you. Elaine Pagels, personally, and even brought her to the school, but both of you and I got to meet her. And so we went through quite a few things with Professor Williams, and he's written a few books too. I've seen his name on some things. It's funny how you just don't have time to read these textbooks, all these kind of books that I would like to absorb it some way. We got a lot, we learned a lot from him. He was one of the few professors who was a Christian. So he did, Tarnell, did you ever meet him? Did you meet Professor Conlon either? You remember Professor Gandhi, of course, yeah. He even went to your house for dinner with Mother, as I said last time. But so we learned a lot about the Gnostic religions at that time, because that was the Gnostic Gospels had come out by Elaine Pagels. And the Nagamati, all of the Nagamati books were being translated, and much more coming out. The very odd Gnostic teachings, the Apocryphon of John, and Gospel of Thomas, so many wonderful things and lots of things to talk about, still being studied, just in there to be in the infancy in those days, and still not, there's still a lot more work to do on that. The Dead Sea Scrolls. David seldom got into arguments, you know, with people about these kinds of things, in school or else otherwise. So I say he was more dogmatic than the rest of us. It doesn't mean he was dogmatic in a general sense. He was very open-minded and very understanding. He had a lot of Christian friends. In the schools and the community college he was at, he knew Christians from that, and was actually pretty close to one woman. And talked to, you've probably heard him talk about her over the years. I forget how he used to describe her, but basically she was someone who really had a walk with God, and he recognized that. And she recognized that in David, too. And when I met her, too, she was very respectful, mostly trying to push us into knowing the Christian path and going that direction. But, yeah, it was... another thing, fun thing to talk about with David, so it had a lot to do with when I first knew him. He worked at a furniture store in downtown Edmonds. And the guy who was there, the owner, and you probably, some of you have heard him talk about this, was kind of a shyster, and it bothered David. Eventually David quit because the guy just was so unable to, just kind of a pathological liar. He just couldn't describe anything without lying, you know, and David got to know most of the things that he was talking about, and he knew that he just couldn't seem to just describe things objectively. And if it was to make a sale, it would be even more over the top. And that's what finally did David in. They finally had a parting of the ways. And that's a big argument, from what I understand, because David was driving, I believe, and the owner, I wish I could remember his first name, because David used to talk about him. But, anyway, I used to stop by and see the world that David was living in. He knew a lot about moving. He'd done a lot of moving. And but so doing a furniture store, you end up being both a salesman and a person moving furniture around. You got to know furniture really well during that time. So all old furniture, mostly bought from England, and he was bringing it in and selling like hotcakes. Good fun. You know, I think it was clear, though he never talked about it that way, I looking back on it, I know his idea of what a businessman should be was more like his father. His father was definitely a straight shooter, and his father liked people, and he had good relationships with all of his clients. So it wasn't again, his father proved to him that you could make money without lying. And you could be, in fact, the position was David had was, you'll do better. Long term, you'll do better. And his father had very long term, 20, 30 year relationships with his clients. And so I think he, I don't know whatever happened to that guy, but he, I know David tried to talk to him about some of the higher ideals. It's just difficult. I'm reminded, Dr. Dittman, I was meeting him at that time, and David was very good friends with Dr. Dittman, we all were. But David lived up there at that time. He lived quite a few different places over that 5 years or so, or 4 years before he got married. And so Dr. Dittman was in Edmonds, too. And funny to think that someone like Dr. Dittman, who spoke so highly of mother, eventually got to the point where he turned all the rest of the family against her over an argument. These things happen. Mother, we were talking about this last night, that my mother went into the hospital in 1983, January of 83. It was a demarcation for mother, her life with mother, for sure. Many people left. We continued to meet at the church. The mother had moved over to, from Bonnie's, wanted the cellar house, and so she moved over to the church on 27th Avenue, was 155th and 27th or so. And, So David did most of that stuff during that. He did all, he spoke. We didn't really listen to many talks of mothers, so David mostly spoke, and Keith Halverson also spoke. His mother recovered.
How long was that? How many years was that before mother started giving talks?
Oh, well, she actually gave talks that same year. I think there's two or three talks in 1983. Mm-hmm. And then 1984, a lot more talks. And then 85, she was basically back completely, you know, able to give a full talk and was pretty much aware of what was going on. I think, you know, the more difficult times were those first year and a half or so, mm-hmm. where when she would talk. And she would lose her train of thought, those kinds of things. But she was really back into her original teaching mode by 85 or so. She recovered. She could even play the piano with her left hand, was quite bad. Is that right, Kate? It was her left hand that was. Anyway, one of her hands was affected by the stroke she'd gone through. And but she was learning to play it. Stayed with it. And then Keith had a falling out, and David took over pretty smoothly. Keith had a falling out with Mother. So it was very different in those days from the time before Mother was, had gone into the hospital. And it really was, I felt very strongly at the time that she was clearing the pathway. She didn't want to leave anything to fight over that was, I think now, at the time I just thought she was clearing the deck of people who were not fully engaged, or as fully engaged as she wanted them to be. We don't know what Mother was doing for sure, but it seemed the result was to clear the deck for sure. But I was trying to explain, it's an ongoing thing, to Jill and Greg last night, as thinking about why it was different at the time with Mother, and how it was different. So it was clear to me that it was a big demarcation, a big difference right away. And then we were all shocked to a great extent. To a certain extent, we were shocked like we were with David's passing, because we just weren't. We're expecting it. And I think when you go from, Mother was such a powerful influence, and I was struggling with ways to describe what was it about her. And it was, you know, words like Shakti come to mind, but it really comes down to energy pouring out of her body. An electromagnetic force that did seem to be selective. Some people didn't feel it as much as others. And it isn't necessarily because of anyone's attainment. Although people who were more highly attained could maybe knew they weren't Mother's disciple, they could see that she was great during the earlier time. It's just, one description that came was, it was like being, meeting the Queen of England in a more intimate setting, and getting the opportunity to. The respect you have and the fear of doing something wrong was, that was always the thing, but you did want to be careful what you said. Peter, you must remember that pretty well that time.
She'd take me out to lunch to the chart room, and I wanted to be a little gentleman. And I remember sitting, you know, 3 feet away from her and just feeling these tremendous waves of power coming off of her. And I thought it was like being in the presence of a great king or a queen or head of state, and she had great patience with me.
always wanted to turn the young man into little gentleman. And when we had parked the car, you know, I would get out and run around on her side and open the door and help her out. And always open doors for her. And when we'd get ready to go someplace from her apartment, I'd get her coat off the hook and help her in with one arm and help her in with the other. And she was fully capable of doing all those things. She wanted me to be attentive, and she wanted me to treat her like a lady. And I didn't appreciate it as much at the time. I was just trying to be as good as I could. But I wasn't getting that training from anybody else in my life. It was in the, you know, mid to late 70s, and the tradition at that time was to throw everything out the window. And she didn't, she thought these things had value. She wanted the men to be gentlemen. She wanted the women to be ladies. She wanted the members of the congregation to be presentable and look as good as they could. She wanted the ladies to wear, the young women to wear makeup and, you know, dress nicely. And she wanted the men to cut off their hair, and she wanted everybody to take a bath.
And get married.
And she, you know, she had a real uphill battle. These are all kids. You know, they're wanting to break every rule she ever made. But she was very strict, and those of us that were devoted, you know, had so much respect for her. You just wanted to make her happy. That's all you wanted, is to get her approval. And then, you know, she had the secret weapon. It was really hard to resist, and that was, she loved you so much that
you felt it.
You just wanted, you know, to make her happy. You wanted to please her. And she is very wise. She's very tough. She's a person that you felt really good if you had her on your side. I would think that. I said, you know, I might run into a lot of problems in my life, but with somebody like Mother on my side, I don't think I have to worry too much. It's like having that, you know, you live in a bad neighborhood, but your friend over here that goes out with you every day is 9 feet tall and, you know, weighs 300 pounds, and you just didn't have much to worry about when you had Mother on your side. And
that's a very good way to spend.
And
what's your memories of David, early memories of David, too?
Well, my earlier memories of David were, he had a lot of long hair and a big beard, and you know, he's always been very quiet, and, you know, like by his own admission, he did not want to be in the front of the room. You know, he was a guy that was in the back, never wanted to draw attention to himself. What I do remember is, you know, I'm a visual person, and I took art in college, and I did a lot of life drawing. And I remember he was such a beautiful man. And later, when he shaved all that beard off and cut his hair, he'd be sitting next to Mother up on the stage, and I just thought, my goodness gracious, what a beautiful human being. I'd look at his arms and his wrist and his hands and how it was all formed, and I just thought, man, I just want to draw this guy. And you know, as it turns out, he's fulfilled internally and spiritually every bit of that visual virtue that he had, that beauty that he had. You know, he fulfilled that in his deeds and actions and words many, many, many times over. And I, you know, I've been really, really lucky. I sort of wonder why sometimes, but you know, he ended up living out in our garage, and so I got to, you know, be around him and see him in a lot of circumstances. And I think that, you know, and like I said, at the gravesite, you know, he just, what a wonderful example he is in all these different circumstances. And one of them, and I think I've told this story before, but I had some work to do out in, right by his place there. I wanted to put a garden planter in with some concrete, and I wanted to bust through the concrete to have dirt down there for the plants to grow into. And so I knocked on his door several times, and, you know, I didn't want to disturb him. And I had convinced myself that he was out and he wasn't around. And so I was got the green light to do the work. So I got this great big jackhammer that I'd rented, and I went to work on this concrete. And, my goodness gracious, it's a jackhammer, you know. I mean, it's pounding through this concrete. And, you know, later, like maybe the next day or 2 days later, he said, you know, I was meditating the whole time. You were in there working on that concrete, you know. And he wasn't angry. He wasn't, you know, saying, hey, listen, can you keep it down? You know, he was actually sort of being humorous about it. And I just felt terrible. But, you know, that was then later you think, well, any other human being might have been a little mad at me or might have been a little irritated. And here this guy, you know, shows all this compassion and understanding. And those little things, those little examples are what really goes so much. I mean, words are wonderful. We have so many words. We have books that are full of words. But when you're around a person that shows compassion and understanding and doesn't get mad at you when anybody else would get mad at you, you think, you know, there's something different about this person. I wish I was like that. I wish I could not get mad at people and be kind and be compassionate, and it makes you want to be like that person. And you realize they've got something that's special and that you want that. You want to be like that. So it's great to be around David. You know, he'd stand me up once in a while. He used to get mad at me and Jill, you know, for laughing and making noise and carrying on. And Jill's a little bit smarter than I am, so she got the memo a little bit quicker. But almost up to the very end there, you know, David was getting mad at me for making too much noise. And I can understand why. You know, he's trying to create a some kind of an atmosphere. But, you know, I never thought that he was wrong. I always thought he was right, you know. He was trying to make it better for all of us. He always did that. Another time, we were up at Loon Lake, and, you know, I traveled great distance. It takes me 2 days to get there, and he announced that I come to see my spiritual brothers and sisters, my family that I miss so much. And he announced we're all going to be in silence. Well, I came all this way, and the social part of it for me is really important. And so I got into a big old snit and, you know, was mad at David. And, you know, he could have just gotten firm and said, you know, we'll take it or leave it. This is the way it is. And he was humble. He apologized to me. And I'm thinking, why is he apologizing to me? And once again, you have a human being that's rising to a level that is not what a normal person would act like. And you say to yourself, yes, this is what an example of how a person should be. You know, here he is humble in a situation where he certainly didn't need to be. And that made a big impression on me. And that would happen over and over where I'd see he would demonstrate in some way or another that he had a state of consciousness that was not your run-of-the-mill human selfish consciousness. And that makes a big impression on us.
I just had a little thought of him as Larry was talking about him doing services while Mother was not well. And I just was thinking about when Mother came back to give services, and she was weak in her body, and she couldn't see because she'd had shingles in her eyes. And so David would help her out during service, and he'd help her up to the podium. And, well, first of all, he would read the Bible service, mm-hmm. and then he would help her up to the podium. And he was just always the perfect example of a devotee service to her. So patient, so protective, so egoless. I remember when he first started giving talks, or he'd be reading the Bible. I remember one circumstance, and he was starting to read the Bible, and Mother behind him was saying, louder, louder. And he didn't even flinch for a second to that kind of either embarrassment or don't tell me this is, you know, in front of everybody, or say it quieter or whatever. He raised his voice a little bit and just carried on. And it was just that evenness in his spirit that I think very few people would have been able to have that. no embarrassment, no, you know, no resistance to her correcting him. So that was a great example. And then also, I can think of the number of times where I would sit and see him. Other people are getting up after service, kind of socializing. We all love seeing each other. David's still there, completely quiet, completely withdrawn. And you could tell that he isn't just making a show of it. He's really in there, and he doesn't hear all this that's out there, and he's able to just continue to be withdrawn and to be meditating on God after service. That's two of my early memories.
I want to say one more thing about David. When I met Mother, she was already there. And it's like she was on the summit of Mount Everest, and I was down in the valley. And the really wonderful thing about David is when we all started out, he was just one of us. He was just another kid in the classroom, you know. And once in a while, one of the kids steps up and decides, you know, I'm going to take this seriously. This is what I'm going to do. And David did it. So we got to watch, you know, somebody literally. Now imagine this. We got to watch somebody transform from the human to the divine. And you can read about it all day long. And then you see it happen right in front of you. And that does a couple of things. But the most important one is it says to you, it's possible. You just witnessed it. It's not impossible. It's not something that happened 2,000 years ago. It happened right before your very eyes.
Deal?
Just as Peter was talking about that, that was my sense. And I don't think I would have stayed on the path had I not watched David go from the human to the divine. And I knew him first as a coworker and a buddy and as silly a things as diet competitions, or we weighed in together every week, so very, very human, very physical kind of experience. And then to get a sense of who he was, and it took me 7 years to do anything with the spiritual group of being friends with David, because my sense, and it wasn't his at all, but my sense was if I didn't agree with his spiritual practices or whatever it was, that I didn't quite know what it was, that it would cause a rift in our friendship. And so I didn't want to risk that until it became imperative that I go. And that was when he first came back in 95, 96, that I went to the first thing that he hosted himself, the solstice celebration that was just a few of us, maybe 8 people or something, in his house that he was renting part of.
Do you remember meeting him the first time?
Yeah, I met him the first time in my job interview. He was part of a team that interviewed me. And we were working together about 3 hours a week. And within a month, I arranged it so we were working together about 40 hours. I applied to replace somebody else in something, and so.
Were you seated at your desks and near each other?
Yeah. Well, we had an office for half of the week. We had an office, so it was just the two of us in a whole satellite thing. Mm-hmm. And then the other half, our desks were right next to each other in a bullpen.
I'm going to tell a little story about what David said about Jill when she first came. Somebody in the group, Jill had just started coming to meetings, and just seemed like she just fit right in, and everybody loved her. And she seemed to us like she was just part of the group forever. And somebody said, well, why, how does she fit in so well? And David just says, well, she showed up and she said, what can I do to help? And that still carries on today.
And a very great example. That's my, in the work setting, at first I was quite jealous of David because he would get all this respect and all this kind of admiration. We would have these huge discussions. There's like 10 of us or 8 of us on a team. We'd have these huge discussions of how something should be dealt with and back and forth and these big debates. And David would just sit there and listen. And sometimes it'd go on for an hour and a half of how this situation would be remedied. And all the pros and cons would be weighed and voices would be raised and David would just be sitting there. And he wasn't in charge. He was a coworker and there was two bosses above us that would be in these meetings. And then at the very end of the discussion, David would say, well, I was thinking blah, 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 blah. And the bosses would go, oh, you're right. And then it would be every single time.
That is the cutest story I ever heard.
And so then my...
You're like the only one who noticed it, huh?
Well, he became very well respected, but never was in charge by choice, I think. But it was... So then my mantra became, you know, be David Hickenbottom. Be David Hickenbottom. And so I would sit in the meetings and try and not give my opinion, which you can imagine.
This is excruciating. I feel your pain. Like,
I want everybody to listen to me like they listen to David. I didn't ever get there, but that would be my...
The interesting thing, too, that Jill would bring those stories home, and I'd be in some really frustrated moment, and she would just start into that mantra for me.
Be David.
I haven't really known it. Fortunately, that changed.
And that evolved, obviously, into spiritual talk, and when we'd have times. Because we were our own bosses down in Auburn, we would sometimes have 2-hour lunches that were our staff meetings that would all be about talk of God and the spiritual path. And I would feel that, I'd say, change in the air. And it's like the aware of the molecules shifting in the air when we were talking and the sensations. That was my first real sense that there was something beyond this.
You know, they say coveting is a sin, right? But there's one instance where it's not. And that's when you want what a great scripture master has.
Yeah. And they want you to have it more than anything else. I would apologize to him when I would do something wrong. And his response was always, how can I be mad at you? All I want for you is your highest good. You know, how can you think that I would be upset with you about doing something that hurts you? It's all I can want for you is your highest good. And that's when I would sin or misstep. That was always his response.
Sharmel, can I put you on the spot too? Can you remember David in those years very well?
David and I connected mostly through bhakti, mm-hmm. because we were both super devotees of Mother. Mm-hmm. And, I always saw David as a kind of a younger brother mm-hmm. kind of figure to me at the mm-hmm. time. And it was pretty magnificent to come back to the group and find that David had achieved all that Mother spoke of. And it was like, oh, magnificent. You know, that he actually did it. And that whole idea of the fact that someone who started out just like me actually made it to that high pinnacle of realization.
Proving
mother's teachings. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Proving mother's teachings. So that was the main thing I remember, was that we would share different things about devotion, and it was a very heartful. You know, I didn't know David really well.
No, I know that. I was curious what you had.
I wasn't really in his same circles, mm-hmm. but the times that we connected, that was the way that we connected. And so it was like we magnified mother together, mm-hmm. When we got together. That was the feeling of it.
He and I also always came to your kirtans, so.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's another thing I remember.
Yeah. So that was it. Mm-hmm.
Steve? You mind?
Well, you know, you and I and David and Michael McCurley used to pal around together, mm-hmm. and so I thought of him always as a pal, you know. And then as he sort of evolved, I saw that evolvement, and every time he did a talk here or wherever it was, it was just something just to look into his eyes and thank him for everything he was doing.
Right, exactly.
And just feel the love.
And the power of his hugs. It's very interesting how powerful they were.
Oh, yeah. Like mother's hugs, you know. We all learned how to hug through mother, I think, and then we pass it on. So, yeah.
Even in India, mother has said, the old boys never had it so good. I love that. I guess you could say something like that.
It takes the most reverent to be irreverent.
Bob, do you have memories of David in the late 70s?
You mean good memories?
Either one.
As long as they're true memories.
Yeah, I was going to say honest memories.
Well, I tend to be more of a critic of David. I admit he's a lot better off than me in numerous ways, but...
honest memories.
Well, sure. When I first met him, I noticed he was willing to extend himself to help other people, and that was good. And, what bothered me is when he dumped Elvie. I just never have gotten over that. I just cannot. I wonder, he said that not dumping her was committing suicide or something, and he was guided by God. Maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. But in either case, it made his word absolutely worthless. And that is carries
for that time
tons of weight. I mean, because a person is good as their word. And he's having other people take vows, but he doesn't keep his. So that, I tried to ask somebody who knew more about it, but they wouldn't say.
Well, I think on the spiritual path, the first vow is to God. So you have priorities in life.
Of course, Swami Ramdas dumped his wife too. So I guess it's pretty common.
Mother had a divorce too. Mm-hmm. Mother had a divorce too.
Yeah.
Those were tough times for him, though, I tell you.
He said it was really hard.
It was, yeah.
And it was the start of and part of the dark night of the soul. So much was lost.
You know what I find encouraging, Bob? He stuck around.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, I tangled up in it. I don't know how to get out.
I think of the...
Oh, it's got you.
We all feel that way.
I always think of the Indian story with the guru that's gone in and is in the house of ill repute, and then the alcohol comes by. Somebody brings in alcohol and someone else brings in meat, and slowly all the devotees leave, and the master comes out in the morning, and there's one devotee left sitting there and says, why didn't you leave?
His name was Bob, wasn't it?
His name is Bob.
It was Bob. Now that you mentioned it.
And he said...
And the master says, why, when all the others have left, why are you still here? And the devotee says, I had nowhere else to go.
This puts it on the plane of real life existence, where life really is.
I have something to say that can kind of go for a little postscript to Bob's. So there were some times as I always loved David as a friend and admired his position and never questioned his mother leaving her mantle to him. But there was a little doubt in me, like, well, how can people think he's really like mother? Because no one's like mother, and no one's, you know. And so there was hesitations in my mind during those some early years of his him being a guru himself. And then one day after service, and I was giving him pronouns, he was pronouming to me, and it's like I could see those megaphones that you see in the big horns that come into my ear. And Mother said, this is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased. And she said it right into my ear, and that let go all any criticisms that I might have, or, well, he doesn't do this as well, or, you know, anything like that. It was just, yes, just complete. He's her beloved son. She's well pleased, and therefore he's beloved to me. And I think there was certainly another, a much deeper relationship I had with him after that time, because I think he could feel that in me. And then there was just, when we would see each other, then it was just God bowing to God. It was really lovely. So there, Bob, there's my answer to your what you said. You can't deny Mother's megaphone. She gave it to me. Anyway, she gave me that megaphone.
Rebecca, can you comment on meeting David for the first time in 2013 at the ashram, of all the auspicious places in Tunisia, huh?
That was...
Do you remember details?
I do remember. It was my first time in India. I was just traveling around for 1 month in India, and it was toward the end of that time. And I really kind of felt like I was completely out of my element. And just hanging on with both hands to God to guide me through the whole adventure. And I found, it was getting toward the end of the time, and I didn't know where else to go. I was in Tiruvannamalai, a Brahmana ashram. And I was in communication with John, and I said, what was the name of that other place you went to when you were here in the 70s? He said, all I know it was called Anandashram. That's all I can tell you. I don't remember where it was.
Is that poor memory?
In Tiruvannamalai, I Googled Anandashram, found out where it was, and bought a ticket for the train and went there. And I had never heard of Papa or Ramnam or anything at that time. And in fact, my first impression of the ashram was like people walking around in a circle with these little tinkling cymbals, chanting the same thing all day long. I was like, I don't know about this. But I was there for 3 days, and that little window of 3 days just happened to coincide with when David and Carla were there. Mm-hmm. And it was right around the time that Christine left the body. So they hadn't left the ashram yet, but it was getting close to that time. Mm-hmm. So just a 3-day window, and it was I think on the second day of my being there, and I attended the 3:30 satsang, and some ashramites said, oh, you're from America, and David is here from America, you must meet him. And I had kind of an attitude that I'm not proud of. But I thought, I didn't come to India to hear about yoga from some white guy.
American
a pseudo-spiritual teacher. I've got God. I don't need anybody. I was very skeptical.
So were you there for a couple of days before you came?
One day, I didn't attend anything. I just stayed in my room and peeked out the window. Mm-hmm. And then the second day, the ashramites, I think it was Shruti actually, was like, you must come. So I attended that satsang, and then it was like, you must meet David. I wish I could say that I fell at the ground and was like, my guru, I've met you at last. I wish I could say I recognized who he was. But I remember standing in the courtyard outside of the Centenary Hall, and I shook his hand and met Carla there with them. And David said, wow, you've been traveling all around India. You know, why don't you come to our room after dinner, and you can just tell us about your travels. So I went back to my room, and I remember pacing back and forth in my room. I was very disturbed. I did not want to go. Mm-hmm. Something in me was just like, I'll just make an excuse. I'll say I'm not feeling well. I'll give some excuse about why I can't come.
Weird.
So I went. So, but it was not the truth in me. So I had to go because God within me said to go. So I went. I was a devoted SRF disciple at the time. Okay. And when I went into David and Carla's room, they had a picture of Lahiri Mahasha on the shelf in their room. And I thought, well, they love Lahiri Mahasha. I love Lahiri Mahasha. Maybe they're not all bad.
So at that point, you didn't know that the Yogananda connection with David and Carla was great.
And strangely, John was a disciple of Mother Hamilton's in the 70s, and he tried to tell me about Mother and how much she meant to him. She was his guru. He said, I lived for Wednesday nights when he would go to service. Mm-hmm. And he even queued up talks from the Cross and Lotus website for me to listen to. And I was not interested. She came on too strong. I'm so sorry to say that to Mother, too.
Well, but, you know,
but
you always have to remember that Master's first meeting with his own master ended in a dispute.
Yeah, disharmony was there.
These are powerful things that happen.
So what was interesting is John had tried to introduce me to Mother, and I just, like, it didn't resonate.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And so when I went to David's room, and the wall came down like a few feet when I saw Lahiri Mahasha's picture. I was like, oh, okay, there's something here. And I don't remember a word that David said. He talked the whole time, I think for about an hour, I was in the room. I think Carla just kind of, as she did, just kind of faded into the background and let me have that time with David. And he started talking about Mother Hamilton. And he handed me a picture, framed photo of Mother. And I remember he handed me the picture. I held the photo, and I was looking at him while he was talking. And then I glanced down at the picture. And by the end of that time, I was only looking at Mother's picture. And there was that Shakti, and I was like, she knows me, and I know her.
Had you not seen a picture of her before?
No.
Or did you pay attention to her?
I had not seen a picture of her before. I don't recall seeing a picture on the website. It was only listening to the talk. So I'd never seen a picture of her. And so that what I remember from meeting David was meeting Mother. Yeah. And I didn't even, in more ways than one, I didn't even see David.
Yeah, the first time I first met you, you were coming out to see Mother's, you came for her mom's
for
money.
For Mother, yeah. And so that was my first meeting with David, and it just amazing to me that you know, half on the other side of the world, yeah. in this little window of time, of three, of that little window of time that I just happened to be like, I don't know, I'm traveling around, I don't know where to go next. I'll go to Anandashram. And he just happened to be there then. And they left, I think, shortly after, mm-hmm. like within a day or two after that, they were called back to be there for Christine. So it was very, very blessed. Oh, well, just one more thing I'll say to kind of conclude the story. When I returned from India and I told John, well, actually, I called him on the phone just before I was going to fly home. And I said, so I met Mother Hamilton's successor here at Anandashram. And at the time, he was like, that's quite something. So it takes a couple days to kind of get myself back home to America. And during the time, when John picked me up from the airport, he said, you know, I've had these few days to think about it. He's like, it is not a coincidence that you met Mother Hamilton's successor at Anandashram. And so he was the one, actually, because I wasn't awake to that within myself, but he really pushed me to say, this is, you need to find out. There's something important here. He said, I think you might have met your guru. So he knew. Wow. I didn't know. But he was right.
When did that become clear to you?
Shortly before John left the body in 2016. I'm sorry to say again, even Kriya initiation in 2014. Mm-hmm. So within 9 months of first meeting David, we went to him for Kriya initiation. And even then, I still didn't feel, I didn't think of him that way. I had reverence. I had respect. I was getting to know him through listening to his talks all the time. And it wasn't until a matter of maybe a couple weeks before John left the body. And I was in Ashland. We lived in Ashland. And John had gone to India, and I would go every Thursday up Mount Ashland and just walk around on the mountain and meditate on the mountain. And it was on one of the mountain days, and I was just walking along, and all of a sudden, in my heart, I was talking to David. And it was a revelation that came through my whole being. He is my guru. And so it was only a few weeks before John left the body that I finally knew, when the veil was lifted. And perhaps that was because John was a spiritual guide, and God had something for me to learn from John. Mm-hmm. And when John was ready to leave the body,
John the Baptist.
Yeah. I think of it as kind of like a you're holding somebody else's baby, and then they kind of get a little smelly, so you kind of like hand them off. Here, you can take her now. She needs a lot. She needs something. She needs work. You can take her now. So like I was handed off to my spiritual father, the true guru.
Great.
Yeah. I think I got to know David clearly just kind of socially as a buddy, as Jill talked about.
So what would it have been? Did you go to lunch with them sometime, or did he come to dinner?
It was, at first it would be, well, I think out of the most vivid memory I have is we had a big Halloween party that everybody was in costume, and he and Elvie came as a couple from Mars or something. They were all in. I just remember David had full silver paint on, and so did Elvie.
Kind of like the moon we just saw.
Yeah. And just, you know, I was just struck myself with, well, Jill has such fun people she gets to work with. And I hear stories about them would take clients on camping trips, and Jill would come back from the weekend and talk about these camping trips. So I kind of knew David that way, and then we did. He was a bit of a hiking buddy that we went on a few hikes, and that was really enjoyable. So it was always in that regard. And then as Jill became more involved in the group, I was following along in that pattern, and we hosted a couple of meditations at her house, and I think that's when I really got more involved. But it was so much of thinking of David as a friend and a buddy, and helping a lot around her house, keeping things up. And I don't think I'd started to truly appreciate who he was until 2005, when Henry and I traveled with he and Carla.
Yeah.
And in particular, he was invited to give a talk to another group that was visiting Anandashram, a big group of about 30 that was traveling all around India. And the devotees of another, he was a Westerner from Germany.
I know who it was, yeah.
But they really wanted, they had heard some of the American guru, and they wanted to have a talk with him. And David said, you know, why don't you come along, Greg, and just hear what's the conversation like.
You hadn't taken Kriya at that time?
No, I had. I'd taken Kriya in 2000.
So you were that far involved?
Yeah.
You're right to point to the thing. But when do you know he's your guru? That is the thing.
And it was just so moving in a way to see David in the first time, in a way, being so familiar with him, to see him in the eyes of all these other souls, that of how bright a light he was. And just the interesting thing for me of seeing, I think at one point, both he and this other spiritual leader were answering questions, and it was you'd get one level of question from the one fellow, and then David would go to a whole different level, and go, oh, I see what it is. So that's really I'm so grateful for that time we had.
Yeah, that was amazing. It really was. I don't know, you guys are really. And take Henry with you to the airplane.
Yeah. And just so many of the other playful times, and how I could get pretty wrapped up around work and get so hard on myself, and David would take me aside and just kind of, you know, ease up and
help me.
But often when you would be so wrapped up in some huge project and overworking so many hours, David would call and say, I've got this problem with my plumbing. I need you to come down and help me.
And I would drop everything and go help David. And then he would counsel me along the way.
He so appreciated that. Anybody online want to weigh in? You have to press the unmute yourself, please.
I would share if, can you hear me?
I pressed the wrong button.
Did you turn everybody off?
Yeah.
Did you end the meeting?
No.
Yes, we can hear you.
Oh, you can?
Yes.
Oh, good. I messed up here.
Go for it, Myra.
Oh, you can hear me?
Yes. We can hear you, Myra.
Sorry.
Oh, good. Thank you. Oh, boy. David, I know I've shared before, but David took us on God walks in Sunday school, and we would get stale bread from the grocery store and a pack of donuts, not for the ducks. And we would walk down to Matthews Beach from my Grandma Bonnie's house. And every moment of our time together was joyful. I don't remember a single skirmish between so many kids. Those Kohler kids, you know, they were. Just kidding. We were like siblings, a lot of us. And, we just felt like David was the most fun, loving jungle gym type of person. You know, he played with us. He pushed us on the swings and threw us up into the air. And he was just so loving to us. And back in our Sunday school classes, he would guide us on these beautiful meditations, and never had I felt so peaceful, like it was exactly where he wanted to be. And you might think kids aren't really geared for like laying still and visualizing, but he would lead us down, you know, stairs of light into a quiet, peaceful place with each progressive step calming us further. Until we were just joined with that warm, soft light at the bottom of the stairway. And it was just an experience of pure love. And growing up, as he became more and more established in the self, It was a little bit, you know, it was a transition from going from over familiar almost to respecting that being established in the greatest love and light there is. Which was sometimes kind of a challenge. It was sometimes kind of hard to like, wait, you bet you're David, you know. And at home, yeah, I had one parent who was absolutely, you know, following all the words of mother. Like, this is, I'm handing my mantle. I'm passing my mantle to David. I completely trust he has been through everything I've been through. And so my father was able to just go along with that because that was what he did. He was very much a bhakti and very much devoted to mother, and no matter what she said. And my mother had a much harder time with the transition because she was so attached, and she was not a bhakti. She was so attached to mother, and her respect and her devotion were 100% with mother, and felt that it was not her path to make that transition to David. And it was many years later, so that was confusing for me as a young woman, teenager, after mother had her stroke, and then especially after she passed away and I was 15 years old. And so there was this kind of diverging a little bit to like, well, I'm going to stay with mother and I'm going to do my own meditation on my mother's part. And I thought, well, yeah, that seems right. And it was years later when my mother said, you know, I see that you're, I went off to college. I started a family shortly after that. I was off in Alaska. It was very much a time when I was on my own and didn't need a guru or, direction. And then I started attending more services. And then my mother said, I see that you're feeling more drawn to David's group. And that is a good thing. And I think that is a good direction. And it was like she had this huge change of heart later where she accepted David as truly a master and saw that I was drawn that direction and really gave her blessing to that.
Interesting. Yeah, I remember with your mom, she did make a, she did turn around on that. She knows.
Yeah.
She talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mira. Very interesting. Some, yeah, a lot of stuff we, you know, we don't hear much from those days of him being a Sunday school teacher and what it was like for you kids. Yeah.
Oh boy, when we had our camp outs at what we called Grandma's Farm, a family property in the South Puget Sound. He was just loads in the water with us on anything that floated. And
yeah, he always brought something to float to.
Just so, it was just such a great time. Mother didn't stay overnight at those places. She was not one to go camping. I think she'd had enough hardship in her life. But we just, it was just a time of joy and laughter and, you know, beach fires and hot dogs and marshmallows and sunshine and sunburns, especially Larry and Jared. They were always sunburned. But David's light just shone on all of us out there. I just have such joy-filled memories of a young life around him. Like I had always known him.
Anybody else?
I'll say a little bit.
Okay.
Just a second here. Good. Technology is letting me down.
We hear you, Jerry.
Yeah, we can hear you fine.
Okay, now I'm ready to roll. My first recollection of David was that the impression I had, he came to Victoria with Mother and he gave the talk. And he struck me as being quite absolutely single-focused, one-minded, single-focused on God and on Mother. And it wasn't like that I thought he was a simple man or a simpleton, but he was a simple man in some ways, that he kept his life uncomplicated that way by being focused on God and on Mother. The odd thing is I had hardly any conversations with him, really strictly speaking on a personal level to do with spiritual matters. But I was lucky in that when he and Carla came to Victoria, they always gave me a call. They would come on a Friday afternoon. They would give me a call. I'd meet them somewhere downtown. We'd go and have a meal in a restaurant. And to be honest, I don't know what I talked about, but I'm sure by osmosis, I got a lot of extra blessings there across the table. And also it was uncanny because there usually would be a few things sort of rummaging around in my head that I would think, well, maybe I should ask about this or ask about that. And then sure enough, in service on Sunday, David would tend to address all those things for me. So I didn't even have to really ask. They all, you know, the questions were dispelled. So I just count myself crazily lucky, like really. It's impossible to really explain to have been lucky enough to have Mother find me and then to have David to support me on my spiritual dirt journey. I explained it to one of my friends who was curious. She's not part of our group, but she does listen to talks online. And I said, well, my overall impression, and by no means am I an authority, so quote me if you wish, but I kind of visualize it for myself as Mother having basically blasted a hole in the fabric of the universe to let light through for everybody. And frankly, that was a little bit over my head. And David came to give me some detailed support, you know, details of how to do this, how to live the life this way, how to live the life that way. So he made it very approachable on a very, you know, easy to understand kind of a level, or easier to understand kind of a level as to how to proceed with everything. I'm really very grateful for having met them both.
It's interesting, Jerry, that you say that, because I had that same sense of Mother's work of it just going right over my head when I would listen to her talks. And then when David would read the transcripts of the talks, I could understand it. Without him explaining it, but when he would read from Mother's talks, then it was all clear to me.
I also think that was a very good explanation, Jerry, is that Mother did do that in all of our lives, just blasted us with this amazing power of God. And then how lucky we were to have David then support us as devotees, as her devotees, because he never tried to get between us and Mother. He enhanced it and he supported it, and to help us then with the next steps in our journey if we allowed him to do so, and really supported us in that in every way. A great master will do that. Swamiji was like that at Anandashram. I never had to think, oh, I'm being disloyal to Mother, because he always would say to me, if we were talking about something, what would Mother say? Ask Mother what she would like you to do. He always supported that guru relationship.
I also found David's teachings to be very, very practical, very, there was nothing theoretical. No, I shouldn't say there was nothing theoretical, but he brought it so down to a level where I could, like in details, practical details, this is what you can do. Otherwise, it just seems overwhelming. And so he made it very approachable that way, I thought.
Well, thank you, Jerry. I'm sorry that we didn't get to the rest of the people. I think we have more to say. I think we'll close for now. Maybe we should do this again. Please pray with me. Oh, Heavenly Father.
Oh, Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
I feel the wonder and the beauty
of thy glorious presence.
Of thy glorious presence.
In every part of my being.
In every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet.
I surrender myself to thee.
I surrender myself to thee.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
I feel the power of thy perfection
surging in every cell of my body.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
My mind and my intelligence
are radiant with thy healing light.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am thee.
Blessed Spirit, I am thee.
Oh.